maybe I wasn't so admirable. From then on, I became distrustful. Since I was bleeding slightly, there was no escape for me. They would devour me. My relations with my contemporaries were apparently the same, and yet subtly out of tune. My friends hadn't changed. On occasion, they still extolled the harmony and security they found in my company. But I was aware only of the dissonances and disorder that filled me. I felt vulnerable and open to public accusation. In my eyes, my fellows ceased to be the respectful public to which I was accustomed. The circle of which I was the center broke, and they lined up in a row as on the judge's bench. In short, the moment I grasped that there was something to judge in me, I realized that there was in them an irresistible vocation for judgment. Yes, they were there as before, but they were laughing. Or rather, it seemed to me that everyone I encountered was looking at me with a hidden smile. I even had the impression at that time that people were tripping me up. Two or three times, in fact, I stumbled as I entered public places. Once, even, I went sprawling on the floor. The Cartesian Frenchman in me didn't take long to catch hold of himself and attribute those accidents to the only reasonable divinity, that is, chance. Nonetheless, my distrust remained. Once my attention was aroused, it was not hard for me to discover that I had enemies. In my profession, to begin with, and also in my social life. Some among them I had obliged. Others I should have obliged. All that, after all, was natural, and I discovered it without too much grief. It was harder and more painful, on the other hand, to admit that I had enemies among people I hardly knew or didn't know at all. I had always thought, with the ingenuousness I have already illustrated to you, that those who didn't know me couldn't resist liking me if they came to know me. Not at all. I encountered hostility, especially among those who knew me only at a distance, without my knowing them myself. Doubtless they suspected me of living fully, given up completely to happiness, and that cannot be forgiven. The look of success, when it is worn in a certain way, would infuriate a jackass. Then again, my life was full to bursting, and for lack of time I used to refuse many advances. Then I would forget my refusals for the same reason. But those advances had been made me by people whose lives were not full, and who for that very reason would remember my refusals. Thus it is that in the end, to take but one example, women cost me dear. The time I used to devote to them I couldn't give to men, who didn't always forgive me this. Is there any way out? Your successes and happiness are forgiven you only if you generously consent to share them. But to be happy, it is essential not to be too concerned with others. Consequently, there is no escape. Happy and judged, or absolved and wretched. As for me, the injustice was even greater. I was condemned for past successes. For a long time I had lived in the illusion of a general agreement, whereas from all sides, judgments, arrows, mockeries rained upon me, inattentive and smiling. The day I was alerted, I became lucid. I received all the wounds at the same time and lost my strength all at once. The whole universe then began to laugh at me. That is what no man, except those who are not really alive, in other words, wise men, can endure. Spitefulness is the only possible ostentation. People hasten to judge in order not to be judged themselves. What do you expect? The idea that comes most naturally to man, as if from his very nature, is the idea of his innocence. From this point of view, we are all like that little Frenchman at Buchenwald, who insisted on registering a complaint with the clerk, himself a prisoner, who was recording his arrival. A complaint? The clerk and his comrades laughed. Useless, old man. You don't lodge a complaint here. But you see, sir, said the little Frenchman, my case is exceptional. I am innocent. We are all exceptional cases. We all want to appeal against something. Each of us insists on being innocent at all cost, even if he has to accuse the whole human race and heaven itself. You won't delight a man by complimenting him on the efforts by which he has become intelligent or generous. On the other hand, he will beam if you admire his natural generosity. Inversely, if you tell a criminal that his crime is not due to his nature or his character, but to unfortunate circumstances, he will be extravagantly grateful to you. during the council's speech, this is the moment he will choose to weep. Yet there is no credit in being honest or intelligent by birth. Just as one is surely no more responsible for being a criminal by nature than for being a criminal by circumstance. But those rascals want grace, that is, irresponsibility, and they shamelessly allege the justifications of nature or the excuses of circumstances, even if they are contradictory. The essential thing is that they should be innocent, that their virtues, by grace of birth, should not be questioned, and that their misdeeds, born of a momentary misfortune, should never be more than provisional. As I told you, it's a matter of dodging judgment. Since it is hard to dodge it, tricky to get one's nature simultaneously admired and excused, they all strive to be rich. Why? Did you ever ask yourself? For power, of course, but especially because wealth shields from immediate judgment, takes you out of the subway crowd to enclose you in a chromium-plated automobile, isolates you in huge protected lawns, Pullmans, first-class cabins. Wealth, cher ami, is not quite acquittal, but reprieve, and that's always worth taking. Above all, don't believe your friends when they ask you to be sincere with them. They merely hope you will encourage them in the good opinion they have of themselves by providing them the additional assurance they will find in your promise of sincerity. How could sincerity be a condition of friendship? A liking for truth at any cost is a passion that spares nothing and that nothing resists. It's a vice, at times a comfort or a selfishness. Therefore, if you are in that situation, don't hesitate. Promise to tell the truth, and then lie as best you can. You will satisfy their hidden desire and doubly prove your affection. This is so true that we rarely confide in those who are better than we. Rather, we are more inclined to flee their society. Most often, on the other hand, we confess to those who are like us and who share our weaknesses. Hence, we don't want to improve ourselves or be bettered, for we should first have to be judged in default. We merely wish to be pitied and encouraged in the course we have chosen. In short, we should like, at the same time, to cease being guilty and yet not to make the effort of cleansing ourselves. Not enough cynicism and not enough virtue. We lack the energy of evil as well as the energy of good. Do you know Dante? Really? The devil, you say? Then you know that Dante accepts the idea of neutral angels in the quarrel between God and Satan, and he puts them in limbo, a sort of vestibule of his hell. We are in the vestibule, cher ami. Patience? You are probably right. It would take patience to wait for the last judgment. But that's it. We're in a hurry. So much in a hurry, indeed, that I was obliged to make myself a judge penitent. However, I first had to make shift with my discoveries and put myself right with my contemporaries' laughter. From the evening when I was called, for I was really called, I had to answer, or at least seek an answer. It wasn't easy. For some time I floundered. To begin with, that perpetual laugh and the laughers had to teach me to see clearly within me and to discover at last that I was not simple. Don't smile. That truth is not so basic as it seems. What we call basic truths are simply the ones we discover after all the others. However that may be, after prolonged research on myself, I brought out the fundamental duplicity of the human being. Then I realized, as a result of delving in my memory, that modesty helped me to shine, humility to conquer, and virtue to oppress. I used to wage war by peaceful means, and eventually used to achieve, through disinterested means, everything I desired. For instance, I never complained that my birthday was overlooked. People were even surprised, with a touch of admiration, by my discretion on this subject. But the reason for my disinterestedness was even more discreet. I longed to be forgotten in order to be able to complain to myself. Several days before the famous date, which I knew very well, I was on the alert, eager to let nothing slip that might arouse the attention and memory of those on whose laps I was counting. Didn't I once go so far as to contemplate falsifying a friend's calendar? Once my solitude was thoroughly proved, I could surrender to the charms of a virile self-pity. Thus, the surface of all my virtues had a less imposing reverse side. It is true that, in another sense, my shortcomings turned to my advantage. For example, the obligation I felt to conceal the vicious part of my life gave me a cold look that was confused with the look of virtue. My indifference made me loved. My selfishness wound up in my generosities. I stopped there, for too great a symmetry would upset my argument. But after all, I presented a harsh exterior, and yet could never resist the offer of a glass or of a woman. I was considered active, energetic, and my kingdom was the bed. I used to advertise my loyalty, and I don't believe there is a single person I loved that I didn't eventually betray. Of course, my betrayals didn't stand in the way of my fidelity. I used to knock off a considerable pile of work through successive periods of idleness, and I had never ceased aiding my neighbor, thanks to my enjoyment in doing so. But however much I repeated such facts to myself, they gave me but superficial consolations. Certain mornings I would get up the case against myself most thoroughly, coming to the conclusion that I excelled above all in scorn. The very people I helped most often were the most scorned. Courteously, with a solidarity charged with emotion, I used to spit daily in the face of all the blind. Tell me frankly, is there any excuse for that? There is one, but so wretched that I cannot dream of advancing it. In any case, here it is. I have never been really able to believe that human affairs were serious matters. I had no idea where the serious might lie, except that it was not in all this I saw around me, which seemed to me merely an amusing game, or tiresome. There are really efforts and convictions I have never been able to understand. I always looked with amazement and a certain suspicion on those strange creatures who died for money, fell into despair over the loss of a position, or sacrificed themselves with a high and mighty manner for the prosperity of their family. I could better understand that friend who had made up his mind to stop smoking, and through sheer willpower had succeeded. One morning he opened the paper, read that the first H-bomb had been exploded, learned about its wonderful effects, and hastened to a tobacco shop. To be sure, I occasionally pretended to take life seriously, but very soon the frivolity of seriousness struck me, and I merely went on playing my role as well as I could. I played at being efficient, intelligent, virtuous, civic-minded, shocked, indulgent, fellow-spirited, edifying. In short, there's no need of going on. You have already grasped that I was like my Dutchmen who are here without being here. I was absent at the moment when I took up the most space. I have never been really sincere and enthusiastic, except when I used to indulge in sports, and in the army, when I used to act in plays we put on for our own amusement. In both cases there was a rule of the game, which was not serious, but which we enjoyed taking as if it were. Even now the Sunday matches in an overflowing stadium, and the theater which I loved with the greatest passion, are the only places in the world where I feel innocent. But who would consider such an attitude legitimate in the face of love, death, and the wages of the poor? Yet what can be done about it? I could imagine the love of Isolde only in novels or on the stage. At times people on their deathbed seemed to me convinced of their roles. The lines spoken by my poor clients always struck me as fitting the same pattern. Whence, living among men without sharing their interests, I could not manage to believe in the commitments I made. I was courteous and indolent enough to live up to what was expected of me in my profession, my family, or my civic life, but each time with a sort of indifference that spoiled everything. I lived my whole life under a double code, and my most serious acts were often the ones in which I was the least involved. Wasn't that, after all, the reason that, added to my blunders, I could not forgive myself, that made me revolt most violently against the judgment I felt forming in me and around me, and that forced me to seek an escape? For some time my life continued outwardly as if nothing had changed. I was on rails and speeding ahead, as if purposely people's praises increased, and that's just where the trouble came from. You remember the remark, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you." Ah, the one who said that spoke words of wisdom. Woe to me! Consequently, the engine began to have whims, inexplicable breakdowns. Then it was that the thought of death burst into my daily life. I would measure the years separating me from my end. I would look for examples of men of my age who were already dead. I was tormented by the thought that I might not have time to accomplish my task. What task? I had no idea. Frankly, was what I was doing worth continuing? But that was not quite it. A ridiculous fear pursued me, in fact. One could not die without having confessed all one's lies. Not to God or to one of his representatives. I was above that, as you well imagine. No, it was a matter of confessing to men, to a friend, to a beloved woman, for example. Otherwise, were there but one lie hidden in a life, death made it definitive. No one ever again would know the truth on this point, since the only one to know it was precisely the dead man sleeping on his secret. That absolute murder of a truth used to make me dizzy. Today, let me interject, it would cause me instead subtle joys. The idea, for instance, that I am the only one to know what everyone is looking for, and that I have at home an object which kept the police of three countries on the run, is a sheer delight. But let's not go into that. At the time, I had not yet found the recipe, and I was fretting. I pulled myself together, of course. What did one man's lie matter in the history of generations? And what pretension to want to drag out into the full light of truth a paltry fraud, lost in the sea of ages like a grain of sand in the ocean? I also told myself that the body's death, to judge from those I had seen, was in itself sufficient punishment that absolved all. Salvation was one, that is, the right to disappear definitively, in the sweat of the death agony. Nonetheless, the discomfort grew. Death was faithful at my bedside. I used to get up with it every morning, and compliments became more and more unbearable to me. It seemed to me that the falsehood increased with them so inordinately that never again could I put myself right. A day came when I could bear it no longer. My first reaction was excessive. Since I was a liar, I would reveal this and hurl my duplicity in the face of all those imbeciles, even before they discovered it. Provoked to truth, I would accept the challenge. In order to forestall the laughter, I dreamed of hurling myself into the general derision. In short, it was still a question of dodging judgment. I wanted to put the laughers on my side, or at least to put myself on their side. I contemplated, for instance, jostling the blind on the street, and from the secret, unexpected joy this gave me, I recognized how much a part of my soul loathed them. I planned to puncture the tires of invalids' vehicles, to go and shout, "Lousy proletarian!" under the scaffoldings on which laborers were working, to slap infants in the subway. I dreamed of all that, and did none of it. Or if I did something of the sort, I have forgotten it. In any case, the very word justice gave me strange fits of rage. I continued, of necessity, to use it in my speeches to the court, but I took my revenge by publicly inveighing against the humanitarian spirit. I announced the publication of a manifesto exposing the oppression that the oppressed inflict on decent people. One day, while I was eating lobster at a sidewalk restaurant and a beggar bothered me, I called the proprietor to drive him away and loudly approved the words of that administrator of justice. "You are embarrassing people," he said. "Just put yourself in the place of these ladies and gents after all." Finally, I used to express, to whoever would listen, my regret that it was no longer possible to act like a certain Russian landowner whose character I admired. He would have a beating administered both to his peasants who bowed to him and to those who didn't bow to him in order to punish a boldness he considered equally impudent in both cases. However, I recall more serious excesses. I began to write an Ode to the Police and an Apotheosis of the Guillotine. Above all, I used to force myself to visit regularly the special cafes where our professional humanitarian freethinkers gathered. My good past record assured me of a welcome. There, without seeming to, I would let fly a forbidden expression. "Thank God," I would say, or more simply, "My God." You know what shy little children our cafe atheists are. A moment of amazement would follow that outrageous expression. They would look at one another dumbfounded. Then the tumult would burst forth. Some would flee the cafe, others would gabble indignantly without listening to anything, and all would writhe in convulsions like the devil in holy water. You must look on that as childish. Yet maybe there was a more serious reason for those little jokes. I wanted to upset the game, and above all to destroy that flattering reputation, the thought of which threw me into a rage. A man like you, people would say sweetly, and I would blanch. I didn't want their esteem, because it wasn't general. And how could it be general, since I couldn't share it? Hence it was better to cover everything, judgment and esteem, with a cloak of ridicule. I had to liberate at all costs the feeling that was stifling me. In order to reveal to all eyes what he was made of, I wanted to break open the handsome wax figure I presented everywhere. For instance, I recall an informal lecture I had to give to a group of young fledgling lawyers. Irritated by the fantastic praises of the president of the bar who had introduced me, I couldn't resist long. I had begun with the enthusiasm and emotion expected of me, which I had no trouble summoning up on order. But I suddenly began to advise alliance as a system of defense. Not, I said, that alliance perfected by modern inquisitions which judge simultaneously a thief and an honest man in order to crush the second under the crimes of the first. On the contrary, I meant to defend the thief by exposing the crimes of the honest man, the lawyer, in this instance. I explained myself very clearly on this point. Let us suppose that I have accepted the defense of some touching citizen, a murderer through jealousy. Gentlemen of the jury, consider, I should say, how venial it is to get angry when one sees one's natural goodness put to the test by the malignity of the fair sex. Is it not more serious, on the contrary, to be by chance on this side of the bar, on my own bench, without ever having been good or suffered from being duped? I am free, shielded from your severities. Yet who am I? A Louis XIV in pride, a billy goat for lust, a pharaoh for wrath, a king of laziness. I haven't killed anyone, not yet, to be sure. But have I not let deserving creatures die? Maybe, and maybe I am ready to do so again. Whereas this man, just look at him, will not do so again. He is still quite amazed to have accomplished what he has. This speech rather upset my young colleagues. After a moment, they made up their minds to laugh at it. They became completely reassured when I got to my conclusion, in which I invoked the human individual and his supposed rights. That day, habit won out. By repeating these pleasant indiscretions, I merely succeeded in disconcerting opinion somewhat, not in disarming it, or above all, in disarming myself. The amazement I generally encountered in my listeners, their rather reticent embarrassment, somewhat like what you are showing, no, don't protest, did not calm me at all. You see, it is not enough to accuse yourself in order to clear yourself. Otherwise, I'd be as innocent as a lamb. One must accuse oneself in a certain way, which it took me considerable time to perfect. I did not discover it until I fell into the most utterly forlorn state. Until then, the laughter continued to drift my way, without my random effort succeeding in divesting it of its benevolent, almost tender quality that hurt me. But the sea is rising, it seems to me. It won't be long before our boat leaves. The day is ending. Look, the doves are gathering up there. They are crowding against one another, hardly stirring, and the light is waning. Don't you think we should be silent, to enjoy this rather sinister moment? No, I interest you. You are very polite. Moreover, I now run the risk of really interesting you. Before explaining myself on the subject of judges penitent, I must talk to you of debauchery, and of the little ease. You are wrong, Cher. The boat is going at top speed, but the Zuiderzee is a dead sea, or almost. With its flat shores, lost in the fog, there's no saying where it begins or ends. So we are steaming along without any landmark. We can't gauge our speed. We are making progress, and yet nothing is changing. It's not navigation, but dreaming. In the Greek archipelago, I had the contrary feeling. Constantly, new islands would appear on the horizon. Their treeless backbone marked the limit of the sky, and their rocky shore contrasted sharply with the sea. No confusion possible. In the sharp light, everything was a landmark. And from one island to another, ceaselessly on our little boat, which was nevertheless dawdling, I felt as if we were scudding along, night and day, on the crest of the short, cool waves, in a race full of spray and laughter. Since then, Greece itself drifts somewhere within me, on the edge of my memory, tirelessly. Hold on. I, too, am drifting. I'm becoming lyrical. Stop me, Cher, I beg you. By the way, do you know Greece? No? So much the better. What should we do there, I ask you? There one has to be pure in heart. Do you know that their male friends walk along the street in pairs holding hands? Yes, the women stay home, and you often see a middle-aged, respectable man sporting mustaches, gravely striding along the sidewalks, his fingers locked in those of his friend. In the Orient likewise at times. All right. But tell me, would you take my hand in the streets of Paris? Oh, I'm joking. We have a sense of decorum. Scum makes us stilted. Before appearing in the Greek islands, we should have to wash at length. There the air is chaste, and sensual enjoyment as transparent as the sea. And we... Let's sit down on these steamer chairs. What a fog! I interrupted myself, I believe, on the way to the Little Ease. Yes, I'll tell you what I mean. After having struggled, after having used up all my insolent airs, discouraged by the uselessness of my efforts, I made up my mind to leave the society of men. No, I didn't look for a desert island. There are no more. I simply took refuge among women. As you know, they don't really condemn any weakness. They would be more inclined to try to humiliate or disarm our strength. This is why woman is the reward not of the warrior, but of the criminal. She is his harbor, his haven. It is in a woman's bed that he is generally arrested. Is she not all that remains to us of earthly paradise? In distress, I hastened to my natural harbor, but I no longer indulged in pretty speeches. I still gambled a little, out of habit, but invention was lacking. I hesitate to admit it for fear of using a few more naughty words. It seems to me that at that time I felt the need of love. Obscene, isn't it? In any case, I experienced a secret suffering, a sort of privation that made me emptier, and allowed me, partly through obligation and partly out of curiosity, to make a few commitments. Inasmuch as I needed to love and be loved, I thought I was in love. In other words, I acted the fool. I often caught myself asking a question, which as a man of experience I had always previously avoided. I would hear myself asking, "Do you love me?" You know that it is customary to answer in such cases, "And you?" If I answered yes, I found myself committed beyond my real feelings. If I dared to say no, I ran the risk of ceasing to be loved, and I would suffer, therefore. The greater the threat to the feeling in which I had hoped to find calm, the more I demanded that feeling of my partner. Hence I was led to ever more explicit promises, and came to expect of my heart an ever more sweeping feeling. Thus I developed a deceptive passion for a charming fool of a woman who had so thoroughly read true love stories that she spoke of love with the assurance and conviction of an intellectual announcing the classless society. Such conviction, as you must know, is contagious. I tried myself out at talking likewise of love, and eventually convinced myself, at least until she became my mistress, and I realized that the true love stories, though they taught how to talk of love, did not teach how to make love. After having loved a parrot, I had to go to bed with a serpent. So I looked elsewhere for the love promised by books, which I had never encountered in life. But I lacked practice. For more than 30 years, I had been in love exclusively with myself. What hope was there of losing such a habit? I didn't lose it, and remained a trifler in passion. I multiplied the promises. I contracted simultaneous loves, as at an earlier period I had multiple liaisons. In this way I piled up more misfortunes for others than at the time of my fine indifference. Have I told you that in despair my parrot wanted to let herself die of hunger? Fortunately, I arrived in time and submitted to holding her hand until she met, on his return from a journey to Bali, the engineer with graying temples who had already been described to her by her favorite weekly. In any case, far from finding myself transported and absolved in the whirlwind, as the saying goes, of passion, I added even more to the weight of my crimes and to my deviation from virtue. As a result, I conceived such a loathing for love that for years I could not hear La Vie en Rose or the Liebestod without gritting my teeth. I tried accordingly to give up women, in a certain way, and to live in a state of chastity. After all, their friendship ought to satisfy me. But this was tantamount to giving up gambling. Without desire, women bored me beyond all expectation, and obviously I bored them, too. No more gambling and no more theater. I was probably in the realm of truth. But truth, cher ami, is a colossal bore. Despairing of love and of chastity, I at last bethought myself of debauchery, a substitute for love which quiets the laughter, restores silence, and above all, confers immortality. At a certain degree of lucid intoxication, lying late at night between two prostitutes and drained of all desire, hope ceases to be a torture, you see. The mind dominates the whole past, and the pain of living is over forever. In a sense, I had always lived in debauchery, never having ceased wanting to be immortal. Wasn't this the key to my nature, and also a result of the great self-love I've told you about? Yes, I was bursting with a longing to be immortal. I was too much in love with myself not to want the precious object of my love never to disappear. Since in the waking state, and with a little self-knowledge, one can see no reason why immortality should be conferred on a salacious monkey, one has to obtain substitutes for that immortality. Because I longed for eternal life, I went to bed with harlots and drank for nights on end. In the morning, to be sure, my mouth was filled with the bitter taste of the mortal state. But for hours on end, I had soared in bliss. Dare I admit it to you? I still remember with affection certain nights when I used to go to a sordid nightclub to meet a quick-change dancer who honored me with her favors and for whose reputation I even fought one evening with a bearded braggart. Every night I would strut at the bar, in the red light and dust of that earthly paradise, lying fantastically and drinking at length. I would wait for dawn, and at last end up in the always unmade bed of my princess, who would indulge mechanically in sex, and then sleep without transition. Day would come softly to throw light on this disaster, and I would get up and stand motionless in a dawn of glory. Alcohol and women provided me, I admit, the only solace of which I was worthy. I'll reveal this secret to you, cher ami. Don't fear to make use of it. Then you'll see that true debauchery is liberating because it creates no obligations. In it you possess only yourself. Hence it remains the favorite pastime of the great lovers of their own person. It is a jungle without past or future, without any promise above all, nor any immediate penalty. The places where it is practiced are separated from the world. On entering, one leaves behind fear and hope. Conversation is not obligatory there. What one comes for can be had without words, and often, indeed, without money. Ah, I beg you, let me pay honor to the unknown and forgotten women who helped me then. Even today, my recollection of them contains something resembling respect. In any case, I freely took advantage of that liberation. I was even seen in a hotel dedicated to what is called sin, living simultaneously with a mature prostitute and an unmarried girl of the best society. I played the galante with the first and gave the second an opportunity to learn the realities. Unfortunately, the prostitute had a most middle-class nature. She since consented to write her memoirs for a confessions magazine quite open to modern ideas. The girl, for her part, got married to satisfy her unbridled instincts and make use of her remarkable gifts. I am not a little proud, likewise, to have been admitted as an equal, at that time, by a masculine guild too often reviled. But I'll not insist on that. You know that even very intelligent people glory in being able to empty one bottle more than the next man. I might ultimately have found peace and release in that happy dissipation, but there too I encountered an obstacle in myself. This time it was my liver, and a fatigue so dreadful that it hasn't yet left me. One plays at being immortal, and after a few weeks, one doesn't even know whether or not one can hang on till the next day. The sole benefit of that experience, when I had given up my nocturnal exploits, was that life became less painful for me. The fatigue that was gnawing at my body had simultaneously cauterized many raw spots in me. Each excess decreases vitality, hence suffering. There's nothing frenzied about debauchery, contrary to what is thought. It is but a long sleep. You must have noticed that men who really suffer from jealousy have no more urgent desire than to go to bed with the woman they nevertheless think has betrayed them. Of course, they want to assure themselves once more that their dear treasure still belongs to them. They want to possess it, as the saying goes. But there is also the fact that immediately afterward they are less jealous. Physical jealousy is a result of the imagination at the same time that it is a self-judgment. One attributes to the rival the nasty thoughts one had oneself in the same circumstances. Fortunately, excess of sensual satisfaction weakens both imagination and judgment. The suffering then lies dormant as long as virility does. For the same reasons, adolescents lose their metaphysical unrest with their first mistress, and certain marriages, which are merely formalized debauches, become the monotonous hearses of daring and invention. Yes, cher ami, bourgeois marriage has put our country into slippers and will soon lead it to the gates of death. I'm exaggerating? No, but I am straying from the subject. I merely wanted to tell you the advantage I derived from those months of orgy. I lived in a sort of fog in which the laughter became so muffled that eventually I ceased to notice it. The indifference that already had such a hold over me now encountered no resistance and extended its sclerosis. No more emotions, an even temper, or rather, no temper at all. Tubercular lungs are cured by drying up and gradually asphyxiate their happy owner. So it was with me, as I peacefully died of my cure. I was still living on my work, although my reputation was seriously damaged by my flights of language and the regular exercise of my profession compromised by the disorder of my life. It is noteworthy, however, that I aroused less resentment by my nocturnal excesses than by my verbal provocations. The reference, purely verbal, that I often made to God in my speeches before the court awakened mistrust in my clients. They probably feared that heaven could not represent their interests as well as a lawyer invincible when it came to the code of law. Whence it was but a step to conclude that I invoked the divinity in proportion to my ignorance. My clients took that step and became scarce. Now and then I still argued a case, at times even forgetting that I no longer believed in what I was saying. I was a good advocate. My own voice would lead me on, and I would follow it without really soaring as I once did. I at least got off the ground and did a little hedge-hopping. Outside of my profession, I saw but few people, and painfully kept alive one or two tired liaisons. It even happened that I would spend purely friendly evenings, without any element of desire, yet with the difference that, resigned to boredom, I scarcely listened to what was being said. I became a little fatter, and at last was able to believe that the crisis was over. Nothing remained but to grow older. One day, however, during a trip to which I was treating a friend without telling her I was doing so to celebrate my cure, I was aboard an ocean liner, on the upper deck, of course. Suddenly, far off at sea, I perceived a black speck on the steel-gray ocean. I turned away at once, and my heart began to beat wildly. When I forced myself to look, the black speck had disappeared. I was on the point of shouting, of stupidly calling for help, when I saw it again. It was one of those bits of refuse that ships leave behind them. Yet I had not been able to endure watching it, for I had thought at once of a drowning person. Then I realized, calmly as you resign yourself to an idea the truth of which you have long known, that that cry which had sounded over the Seine behind me years before had never ceased, carried by the river to the waters of the channel, to travel throughout the world, across the limitless expanse of the ocean, and that it had waited for me there until the day I had encountered it. I realized likewise that it would continue to await me on seas and rivers, everywhere, in short, where lies the bitter water of my baptism. Here, too, by the way, aren't we on the water? On this flat, monotonous, interminable water, whose limits are indistinguishable from those of the land? Is it credible that we shall ever reach Amsterdam? We shall never get out of this immense holy water font. Listen. Don't you hear the cries of invisible gulls? If they are crying in our direction, to what are they calling us? But they are the same gulls that were crying, that were already calling over the Atlantic the day I realized definitively that I was not cured, that I was still cornered, and that I had to make shift with it. Ended the glorious life, but ended also the frenzy and the convulsions. I had to submit and admit my guilt. I had to live in the little ease. To be sure, you are not familiar with that dungeon cell that was called the Little Ease in the Middle Ages. In general, one was forgotten there for life. That cell was distinguished from others by ingenious dimensions. It was not high enough to stand up in, nor yet wide enough to lie down in. One had to take on an awkward manner and live on the diagonal. Sleep was a collapse, and waking a squatting. Mon cher, there was genius, and I am weighing my words, in that so simple invention. Every day, through the unchanging restriction that stiffened his body, the condemned man learned that he was guilty, and that innocence consists in stretching joyously. Can you imagine in that cell a frequenter of summits and upper decks? What? One could live in those cells and still be innocent? Improbable. Highly improbable. Or else my reasoning would collapse. That innocence should be reduced to living hunchbacked, I refuse to entertain for a second such a hypothesis. Moreover, we cannot assert the innocence of anyone, whereas we can state with certainty the guilt of all. Every man testifies to the crime of all the others. That is my faith and my hope. Believe me, religions are on the wrong track the moment they moralize and fulminate commandments. God is not needed to create guilt or to punish. Our fellow men suffice, aided by ourselves. You are speaking of the Last Judgment. Allow me to laugh respectfully. I shall wait for it resolutely, for I have known what is worse, the judgment of men. For them, no extenuating circumstances. Even the good intention is ascribed to crime. Have you at least heard of the spitting cell, which a nation recently thought up to prove itself the greatest on earth? A walled-up box in which the prisoner can stand without moving. The solid door that locks him in his cement shell stops at chin level. Hence, only his face is visible. And every passing jailer spits copiously on it. The prisoner wedged into his cell cannot wipe his face, though he is allowed, it is true, to close his eyes. Well, that, mon cher, is a human invention. They didn't need God for that little masterpiece. What of it? Well, God's sole usefulness would be to guarantee innocence, and I am inclined to see religion rather as a huge laundering venture, as it was once, but briefly, for exactly 3 years, and it wasn't called religion. Since then, soap has been lacking. Our faces are dirty, and we wipe one another's noses. All dunces, all punished, let's all spit on one another, and hurry to the little ease. Each tries to spit first, that's all. I'll tell you a big secret, mon cher. Don't wait for the Last Judgment. It takes place every day. No, it's nothing. I'm merely shivering a little in this damned humidity. We're landing anyway. Here we are. After you. But stay a little, I beg you. And walk home with me. I haven't finished. I must go on. Continuing is what is hard. Say, do you know why he was crucified, the one you are perhaps thinking of at this moment? Well, there were heaps of reasons for that. There are always reasons for murdering a man. On the contrary, it is impossible to justify his living. That's why crime always finds lawyers, and innocence only rarely. But beside the reasons that have been very well explained to us for the past 2,000 years, There was a major one for that terrible agony, and I don't know why it has been so carefully hidden. The real reason is that he knew he was not altogether innocent. If he did not bear the weight of the crime he was accused of, he had committed others, even though he didn't know which ones. Did he really not know them? He was at the source, after all. He must have heard of a certain slaughter of the innocents, the children of Judea massacred while his parents were taking him to a safe place. Why did they die if not because of him? Those blood-spattered soldiers, those infants cut in two, filled him with horror. But given the man he was, I am sure he could not forget them. And as for that sadness that can be felt in his every act, wasn't it the incurable melancholy of a man who heard night after night the voice of Rachel weeping for her children and refusing all comfort? The lamentation would rend the night. Rachel would call her children who had been killed for him, and he was still alive. Knowing what he knew, familiar with everything about man, ah, who would have believed that crime consists less in making others die than in not dying oneself? Brought face to face, day and night, with his innocent crime, he found it too hard for him to hold on and continue. It was better to have done with it, not to defend himself, to die, in order not to be the only one to live, and to go elsewhere where perhaps he would be upheld. He was not upheld, he complained, and as a last straw, he was